Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Everyone's an Expert. Sorry about the gap between episode 4 and episode 5. I've been away working, and although I had every intention of keeping this going, it just didn't transpire that way. So thanks to those of you that have been asking, and for those of you that gave me abuse about the gap, I think I'm just going to take that as a compliment. My guest this time is the wonderful Andy Dawson. We had this conversation back in February, and it was a real thrill for me because I'm a huge fan of Andy's output as a podcaster with Athletico Mints, which he does with Bob Mortimer, and also Top Flight Time Machine with previous guest Sam Delaney. So it was a real thrill to speak to Andy about the role that music plays in some of his work, as well as just his take on music. Andy's a really, really great fan of music and has a lot of great insight about pop music and its place in culture. So it was a real exciting thing to have a chat with him. Had a great time. Hope you enjoy listening. Cheers. Andy, welcome to Everyone's an Expert. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's a pleasure.
And bit of a sort of Parkinson style smoke blowing to begin with.
Please.
Congratulations on the success of the podcasts. I don't just mean in the sense of, you know, lots of listeners and all that kind of thing, but just kind of, it seems like you've carved out a way of making a living through doing something creative and on your terms, which is pretty inspiring, yeah. I think.
I'll be completely honest with you, and I'm not going to underplay this. It's the absolute dream, because, I mean, I've been working as predominantly a writer for about 25 years for various kind of newspapers, magazines, online outlets. There's always that fear. Firstly, there's always that fear that you don't know where your next paycheck's coming from if you're not doing anything that you're tied down to long term. Sure. Secondly, there's always that thing where whatever it is that you're doing could at any time just get withdrawn or decommissioned or whatever. I mean, on the back of doing the podcast, I did some stuff at TalkSport, presented some shows on there, and that kind of thing was great. But then you're always wondering, how long do they want me for? And what happened to TalkSport was new management came in and they kind of went more down the road of actual sporting content as opposed to arsing about, which is kind of
charlatans.
What I was doing on there, as I was doing on there with James Brown. So that show ended and then we didn't do anything else really with them. And there's always that thing that you don't know, whoever your paymaster is, you don't know when the wind's going to change and whether or not you're still going to be in a job this time next month. So doing this, first of all, having complete creative control, which you do on a podcast. All we've got to worry about is not slandering anybody, which I don't think we have, is fantastic. Secondly, you're your own boss. You can just do whatever you want, whenever you want, take control of the whole thing. That's kind of point one again, isn't it? Creative control. But that whole thing of just being master of your domain almost, it's really satisfying. And you know, no desire to kind of branch out too far away from what I'm doing right now. If other things come along, great, but this is me now for as long as people will listen, I think.
Yeah, it's such a strong position, but I think it comes across, especially in the Top Flight Time Machine stuff, where it's quite kind of day to day and authentic. Mm. Not that Mince isn't, but it strikes me that there's a lot more writing and preparation goes into that. And I think a lot of people that will be listening to this initially probably would be musicians, people that are interested in music, people that are interested in creative career. So there's kind of a big crossover there. Mm. Speaking of music, I had a few things I wanted to chat to you about, really. But I mentioned Athletico Mints. Music's quite a big part of what goes into that podcast now. And I struggle to remember because I listened to the first sort of 10 or 15 episodes in one day once, which I was driving down to the South Coast to pick something up or do something. I can't remember. And a mate of mine said, listen, you've got to check this out. I think it was about 2 years into you doing it. So right. It's a bit of a blur. But Did you guys always intend for sort of musical segments to be a big part of that, or is that something that happened organically?
No, everything that it's become has happened organically. I mean, it did originally start out where we were going to talk about football. We just, because that was kind of the thing that we had in common, was that we're both fans of North East football clubs and we're both of a fairly similar age range. So, getting on a bit. And yeah, we just thought we'll just sit down and we'll talk about football and we'll put it out and see what happens. And then we realised quite quickly that, like, having opinions about football is, there's a lot of that about. And that our opinions didn't necessarily hold any weight. And it just seemed more fun to kind of stray into those other areas. I think I remember quite early on, I think the genesis of what it became was Bob said something in like episode 5 maybe of like, I wonder what Steve McLaren's up to this week, which was just like, you know, quite a footballish sort of thing to say and just a slight aside. And then he speculated about what McLaren might be doing. And then he did it again the next episode, and then it grew and it grew.
Yeah, so it was his.
Caster the Snake came in.
Yeah.
It's all been completely organic. There was never a point where we went, this isn't working, let's make stuff up and have characters and things. It just, if you listen to them back to back, you can almost kind of hear the evolution of it, if you like. I mean, I think one of my favourite characters still is the Alderman. It's got nothing to do with football at all. And I think that just came out of a conversation we had where I was accusing Bob of being overly friendly with the Alderman because Bob is a millionaire and all this kind of thing and he has all this power and influence. And the Alderman just got mentioned a couple of times and then Bob took that and then created the character. And that's the beauty of it, when little things turn into these huge things that then go on and become staples of the podcast.
In the case of Steve and Casper, a full musical number in a live show.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's hard to imagine Steve McLaren now without Casper, if you've listened to Vince.
But I think the way that
shame
you,
for Steve.
Yeah. The way that you guys do that, especially on the I came to the, I say most recent, I mean it's a little while ago now, but most recent live show, it's kind of Morecambe and Wise-esque, really. I don't know whether that's something that you guys talk about or whether it's healthy to get too much into self-analysing, but
we kind of don't talk about it, but we do talk about the mechanics of it, especially with the live show. With the podcast, we don't really discuss what we're going to do. We turn up with our respective bits of stuff and do them.
That spontaneity comes across. Yeah. I always did wonder where, like, and that's, and so your responses there are genuine.
That, yeah.
Surprise that's at one another, enjoying one another's work. Yeah.
That's exactly it. And I think that's one of the secrets to why it's as successful as it is, because it is scripted, a lot of it, but it's not scripted in the terms that we both sit down and create it and then learn it and then do it. Like, if there's a bit that I'm going to be in that he's written, he'll just send me it. And I'll generally not even read it beforehand. We'll just perform it. And vice versa, if I write something, he'll just get it half an hour before we do the recording. So we're both going into it blind. So listening to it,
it's a great concept.
That comes through. But getting back to the live shows, Morecambe and Wise, I'll take that compliment all day long. But we just decided we weren't going to do one of those things where podcasts transfer to the stage, and what they just do is they'll do an episode of a podcast put in front of a paying audience. We felt as though the nature of Mince meant that we could do more with it. And obviously Bob's got decades of experience of performing comedy on stage. So to just sit and do a podcast episode would have been a bit short-changing, I think. So we spent a lot of time writing it, not a great deal of time rehearsing it, because again, that thing of it being loose and a bit half-arsed is a massive part of its charm. But then once the shows got underway, we would change things from night to night if bits felt they were a bit saggy or didn't work or whatever. So it was kind of evolving again throughout the run of the tour. But the fundamental thing with the live shows was it needs to be a comedy show. It needs to be singing, dancing, laughs, characters, wigs, all that kind of thing, because that's the best thing you can do with it. Make the most of what it is in a live setting would be to do that. And then when we did the Top Flight Time Machine live shows, obviously I had experience of doing mints, so I just said, well, let's just do the same, because we've got lots of characters on Time Machine that are recurring, and we can do character stuff and make it really similar, and I think that works really well as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, not to be too sycophantic, as a fan of both of them, I think that effort that you put into the live shows is massively gratifying for fans of it, because it's like you say, it's that plus. It's like the movie version of a program, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
So I mean, we've kind of, I guess, extremely remotely co-composed some stuff.
You are you're pretty much the third member of Top Flight Time Machine, if you like.
Oh well,
I say that to lots of people, though.
I was going to say, yeah. Hey, I'm still going to put it at the top of the fictitious website. I'll put it on a CV.
No, but I mean,
one of the many third members.
Yeah, people listening to this might not know, but you wrote and recorded the music, and you know, wrote the songs that we did in the last live shows, and you've written other bits of music for us. And other than what we contributed to the live shows, you're the only other contributor, and the stuff that you wrote was fantastic and elevated the shows massively. So a public thank you to you for that.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, for me, I do quite a lot of different things, and performing, academia, just, you know, various bits and bobs and writing. But that thing of, I mean, my dream job would be writing those kinds of songs to brief, songs to brief, but I bit your hand off when I had the opportunity to do it, really, especially with something that.
Oh, if we ever decide to record an album, you know, we'll come straight to you. But no plans at the moment.
When you're putting the music stuff together for Mints, is it simply a case of just finding some library stuff? Because some of those recurring sort of changing songs have become a real motif of that podcast now, haven't they?
Yeah, it is this is library music mostly, other than some of my songs, which I create
full
rhythms.
Full composition.
I can't call them anything more than rhythms, really. There's an app where you can just create, like, it's like a drum machine app, and I knock stuff out in that. But the stuff that definitely the stuff that Bob does song-wise is library music, which is weird because sometimes the same tunes will crop up elsewhere in the world, and we get tweets from people who've heard the Steve McLaren song as a background on a CBeeb show. Or there was the worst one was the Peter Beardsley background music came from a library thing, and it was used as a musical bed on a montage of images Holocaust Memorial Day.
Oh God!
Which I mean, the music
it's
itself
an innocent coincidence. And
The music itself is fitting for something like that, and it obviously whoever did it had no knowledge of it being Peter Beardsley's theme music, if you like, but. A lot of people got in touch with us when that happened and pointed that out.
You're one of my favourite kind of people to speak to about music, who I think it's fair to say you haven't played formally music.
No.
Is that right?
No. Other than a couple of occasions of getting together with mates and jamming in a studio.
Did you ever do the being in a band thing as a teenager?
Not beyond that. Not beyond the level of like I say, getting together and trying to knock out some tunes. We got bored of it really quickly because we realised we couldn't do it. So that was never. I bought an electric guitar when I was 16, and I think I was ripped off because it didn't play very well. It might have been me, but it didn't play very well, and I never got to grips with it. And never harboured any ambitions to be a musician, but I was always just like really focused on wanting to be a writer from teenage years.
Right, yeah.
So that was always my thing. And I think being in a band, I didn't have that desire to perform or
get on
stage and show off or anything like that, which it's what I do sometimes now, which I've kind of drifted into almost accidentally. So there was never any of that. It was always passive, listening to music, going to gigs.
So what was the sort of writing and journalism that inspired you to do that? Was that through music journalism or just general stuff? Because that was one thing I wondered about.
In terms of writing, when I was at school, I just wanted to be a journalist on the local newspaper, the Sunderland Echo, because it was just like a job that I wanted to do. I didn't like want to be a writer who wrote great works and all that kind of thing. I just wanted it to... I didn't think that was achievable. Do you know what I mean? It was
right, yeah.
Sort of like I'd like to... I knew I was good at writing from a really early age, and I just wanted to transfer that into a job. And the only way of doing it seemed to be to get some job locally on a newspaper. So that was the ambition. That never happened. But then in terms of creative writing, I think the big influence will have been... probably Viz.
Because, right, sure.
That blew my mind first time I read Viz when I was probably about 14, because it was so funny and so sweary. It was just so outrageous that people were doing that in the late 80s. But then throw in the fact that it was produced locally by fellas.
Right?
It was Chris Donald and Simon Donald.
Oh, right, okay.
Originally
it. Whereabouts were they? Because I'm getting confused. It was a student of mine told me that they were cousins of his. He's from Annie, so maybe it's not so. Of the Viz creators.
Yeah. Chris ended up, I think he ended up living there, but they both lived in Newcastle, just
right,
in
okay.
the city centre. And yeah, I mean, that started out as just a fanzine that they knocked out and photocopied and sold in some local shops. So I started doing the same thing in about 1989. Me and a mate, we started doing our own comedy fanzine, which was a big rip-off of Viz. We sold about 9 copies. There was a bookshop in Sunderland that was selling it, and I remember we went in and we collected the proceeds from the copies that we'd sold, and we bought ourselves a big tub of ice cream, and we rented with Neil and I, and spent the afternoon feasting on the proceeds from this fanzine we did, watching With Neil for the first time, which again was a great, great moment, and scoffing our faces with ice cream.
Yeah.
That was full, yeah, just immediately spent it. So, yeah, Viz was a massive, massive influence early on. And then a few years down the line, I did another fanzine just on my own, because the mate I'd done the first one with had gone off and got a proper job and everything. So I did another one, and I sent that off. It was called The Profanity Swan, which is me moniker on Twitter. That was the name of the fanzine. It means literally nothing. It's just two words juxtaposed together. So I did The Profanity Swan fanzine, which again was Viz-esque. But by that time, Chris Morris had become a big influence as well. So that I'd done 2 issues of that. And I'd sent them around to various music magazines to hopefully get it reviewed and see if I could sell some by mail order.
Right.
And I was on the brink of just packing it in because issue 3 hadn't done anything. And I just sent some more out to the magazines again. Just let's see if anything happens. And I got a letter back from a journalist at the NME called Johnny Cigarettes.
Right,
not his real name, and he was the editor of the Thrills page at the back of the NME. This is 1994, and the Thrills page was made up stuff, jokes, spoof stories, that kind of thing. And he said, "Would you like to contribute some ideas to the Thrills page?" This was just revelatory. I never ever thought anything like this could happen. So he'd asked me to give him a ring, and I was just like jelly. I rang this NME journalist because, as we kind of touched upon, the NME was like the Bible sort of thing for a music fan back then. So to actually be asked to contribute to it was just jaw-dropping stuff. So I rang him up and then started sending stuff in, and regularly got stuff in the pages of the NME. So that's where my writing career started. So long answer, but the influence originally was Viz.
Yeah, and led you to, yeah, led you into, well, yeah, being a published print writer.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess while you were kind of doing that, you were doing other jobs to kind of keep that freelance writing dream alive, so to speak.
Yeah, I wasn't really, because what I did was I'd been working at Our Price, and then the NME work started, and it didn't pay massively, but it paid okay, and it was regular. And then I got introduced to a Radio 4 producer who I started writing some bits of stuff for, with the idea of putting together some kind of sketch show with a couple of other writers. So I made the grand decision to give up the day job, probably prematurely at that point. But I kind of thought, well, let's try and go for this properly instead of doing 8 hours a day behind the counter of a record shop. Let's try and do it properly. And I gave up the lease on the flat that I was living in, moved back in with my parents, age 24, I think I was, and knuckled down to try and become a proper writer. And it took a long time to get anywhere, but made those sacrifices of freedom and independence of living in a flat to go back to me folks' house, which is not easy, but yeah, that's what I did. So there wasn't any kind of other jobs on the side until around about 2001. I've done some call centre work around then as well, because things were getting fairly desperate and I did need to bring some extra money in. So it was kind of, I was just focused on doing the writing the whole time. In truth, I spent most of my days dicking about playing Championship Manager on my PC. But procrastination is a big part of being a writer, I think.
Well, yeah, it's important to, that's where the light and shade comes from.
Yeah.
I think there's some real truth in that, though, for kind of, you know, especially writing, but any kind of creative endeavour. It's hard to just go, right, I'm going to work full time on something else to be sensible. And then in those 2 hours, I'll afford myself. That's my 2 hour window for when inspiration's going to strike. I'm just going to schedule it in for 6:30 to 8:30 on Tuesday night. Doesn't happen, does it?
It doesn't work like that. I mean, I did almost have a plan of moving to London and getting transferred to an Our Price branch in London and doing that, a full time job and then working in the evenings. And it might have worked out, but in the end, I just thought, no, I really want to just properly do this Championship Manager thing.
I'm on a roll here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm worried if I take the console down the M1, I'll lose the saved game.
Exactly.
That's one of these questions, because I'm based in the Northwest, and I've done quite a lot of one of the jobs that I've done is quite a lot of teaching at Music College in Manchester. It's one of the conversations I've a lot of the time. For a lot of students, a lot of young people, is that thing of the draw of London for kind of creative industries. And I gather you've always stayed local while you've been working. Is that right?
I have, yeah. I was going to say, all the work I've always done has been London-based, for London-based outlets, if you like. So I've gone backwards and forwards down there for meetings or for the odd day or two of work at various places, but I've always stayed in Sunderland. There was a time, probably about 20 years ago, when maybe I could have made that move to London again and try to do that. And then my daughter came along. My daughter was born, so that took priority over everything else. So there was no chance of moving to London or anything like that, which I think was, again, it's turned out to be the right thing. I think the cost of living up here is considerably less than it is in London. I think it's hard to go to London and try to do something where you're just scratching and scraping for bits of money here and there. It certainly was for me. And I don't know whether these days everything is a lot more connected with the internet and everything. It's not... I mean, going back to the NME stuff in 94, 95... I was still working in Our Price when I first started doing the NME stuff, And I used to fax my copy to them every week. So I'd, in my dinner break from Our Price, I would go to a nearby insurance company who had a fax machine, and you could send faxes for 10 pence from their fax machine. So that was what I would do. That's how this stuff would get to the NME. Now, of course, now everything's linked up online, and it's so much easier. And it's so much easier to have your own presence online.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's you just do stuff and then put it online and, you know, abracadabra, you'll become a success. But it's easier. There's a meritocracy kind of exists theoretically more than it did then.
I guess as well, you were pretty early to the kind of Twitter phenomenon.
Yeah.
An early adopter, yeah.
Yeah, that was another big thing in terms of work. That was a godsend, because you basically go on Twitter and try and be funny and show off. But then it's also a good way of introducing yourself to people who are in the position to give you work.
Sure.
So it, literally a network and a networking opportunity, Twitter was. And because I was fairly decent at being funny on Twitter, I ended up getting work doing social media stuff for ad agencies, and I did the Twitter account for the Sunday People newspaper for a few years. I was also Monkey from the PJ Tips ads on Facebook. I wrote the copy for Facebook page for a while. So that was, you know, like nice, fairly well paid corporate work, if you like, came in through just being visible on social media and kind of
right, yeah, and being creative.
Yeah,
all the time as well. Yeah.
So and of course that's how I met Bob, through Twitter. So I've got a lot to thank Twitter for, really. So yeah.
Yeah. Because it's, I mean, I guess people, it's kind of trendy to sort of pour scorn on Twitter a little bit these days, but it's good to remember that.
Yeah.
There are a lot of positives from a medium like that.
It's changed so much from what it was originally, without wishing to sound snobby or anything. 10 years or so ago, Twitter was mainly full of what I would call early adopters, tech curious people, who were on there to kind of play with the format and experiment with it, and then the masses got involved, and darker forces got involved, and it's now just become an absolute sewer of just constant arguments. And I don't go on there as much as I used to, but sometimes I'll just have a look, and it's weird. It's like pulling back a shutter and you're just looking into this volcano of just mayhem and spite and bile. And I've been responsible for some of that myself in the past, because I did get too deeply into being on there. But it's changed irrevocably now from what it was back then, and absolutely not for the better. But that's all social media is kind of like that now, I think.
I think, yeah, if you don't kind of force yourself to jump out of a certain thread that you're going down, it's very easy to find yourself. You quickly go from 0 to 60, don't you? You kind of go, that guy's overreacted. What's the other guy said? Oh, and then before you know it, you're furious as well.
Yeah, that's the thing. And I'll quite often now, I'll delete a tweet before I even send it, or think about tweeting something and then think, you know what, it's not worth it. Because it's like the fucking... the fallout from it could just be horrific. So tweet less is my advice.
Yeah. Even if occasionally I've heartily agreed with some of the ones that have got you in a bit of hot water. We'll not go over that. So one of the things that has kind of developed on Top Flight Time Machine are these two weekly episodes where you run down a historical chart, and I mentioned before that you strike me as an aficionado. One of the things I find really interesting about your taste in music is that it is genuinely eclectic. I think so,
yeah. I hope so anyway.
I think a lot of people that are into some left field stuff, it's kind of a position as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think it's fair to say that's it's not an all-encompassing thing for you?
It's I was always massively into pop music as a kid and the stuff that was in the charts. And then as I got older, I graduated, if that's the right word, to stuff like early evening Radio 1, Janice Long, Kid Jensen, and then into John Peel and the more, like you say, left field sort of stuff. But at the same time, it was like a dalliance because I was still always into pop stuff.
Yeah, look,
that's never went away.
I admire that. Yeah, I admire that because I think in a slightly different way, I fell into a kind of a trap, which I think maybe a lot of self-righteous teenagers do. Loved pop music as a kid. Would read Top of the Pops, smash hits back to, you know, cover to cover. Was kind of tried to just glean every bit of information I could. And then I got into jazz, and I think I felt as though that was like some kind of worthy calling.
Yeah,
and sort of denied a lot of the mainstream things that I liked, because I think I bought into this idea of this hierarchy that existed. So I really admire it when people can kind of see through that at an early age. It took me a few years to then go, that's bullshit.
Yeah. I think looking back now, I think that the one group that kind of kept me hooked into pop music all the time, even though I went off into this direction of the weird stuff, was probably Pet Shop Boys.
Okay.
And I love Pet Shop Boys, and the minute they came along, I always have done. They'll be in my top three favourite groups of all time. So even though I was dabbling in stuff, I mean, I got really massively into stuff like Pixies and Dinosaur Jr. and the kind of grunge stuff. And then I got into like a lot of electronica when I was working in our price, because lots of that was being played in the back room by the people I was working with. So there was always weird stuff, but deep down, whenever Pet Shop Boys put something new out, I loved it. So that made me kind of not be ashamed of being in there. And basically now that I'm nearly 50, I just love melody. The thing I want most of all from music is melody, and that goes right back to loving pop music when you're a kid, all the way through to that dalliance with the weird stuff, which I still enjoy. I still enjoy a lot of the stuff that's done, like Six Music, for example. I wake up with Six Music every morning. But that thing of just craving melody is has always been a constant. And Prefab Sprout was another one. I always loved Prefab Sprout.
Cool.
And again, Paddy McAloon is like a pop genius, I think. Well, I never got into the rock behemoths that you're meant to love. I never got into The Who, Led Zeppelin, The Doors, Pink Floyd, all that stuff that young men take really seriously. I never got into that, and it always seemed slightly ludicrous. So that was kind of pop music always seemed better than that for me. Mel and Kim's That's the Way It Is, the last single they did together, for me is fucking infinitely more listenable than Kashmir by Led Zeppelin, and always will be. And it comes back to that thing of melody, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you were talking about football opinions. I love hearing strong music opinions. It's like the thing that is great about it is that it's, I don't know, maybe from a journalistic point of view, you should go, what about, I should offer an opposite opinion.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I quite like hearing that someone, you know, has a strong opinion about stuff, especially a lot of the time, I don't know, professional musicians, academics protect themselves by kind of being quite aloof about opinion about music.
Yeah.
But it kind of separates you from the whole fucking point of it, which is to kind of, it connects with you, or it speaks to you.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
what it's really about, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I always turn my nose up a little bit when people talk about having guilty pleasures. And I think, well, nothing's a guilty pleasure. It's all music, and if you get off
it's just
on
a
it,
pleasure, right?
Great. Yeah, it's a pleasure, yeah. Don't feel guilty about it because you like Mel and Kim. Enjoy it, embrace it. But, I mean, that's interesting because one of the best music books I've read recently was Pete Perfidi's autobiography, Broken Greek. I don't know if you've read that or not. Or
I haven't read it, but I'm a big fan of his writing.
Yeah, Pete Searce. And Pete used to write for Melody Maker back in the days when I was an avid reader of Melody Maker. And Pete said subsequently in recent years that he did that. He suppressed his love of pop music. Because that book is really about his childhood and his love of pop music and his obsession levels. It's a great, great book. Thoroughly recommend it. But when he was at Melody Maker, he said subsequently that he kind of suppressed his love of pop music and almost tried to force himself to like the stuff that was on the agenda then for Melody Maker writers. And in truth, he was cheating on the stuff that he really loved, which was like chart pop. And it's almost brave to sort of admit that, I think.
Yeah, so definitely. Yeah, well, he's another of those people that I, from having spent a few years kind of reading a lot of academic texts about pop music, the way that pop music's written about in academia is so different to the way that it is in journalism. And
right.
I do feel that someone like him, for instance, is just much more tapped into,
I guess,
the importance of it and what it means to the people, the vast majority of people that are consuming it.
Yeah, and there's like an honesty there, which
goes
back to what we've just said previously. I think that sometimes people will get into certain genres of music as a pose. Do you know what I mean? They're pretending to be into it, and there's an honesty of professing your love for a sort of music that's not critically acclaimed. I mean, getting back to pop music again, Girls Aloud for me are one of the best pop groups there's been in the last couple of decades in this country. Not massively into Spice Girls. I don't think the material was that strong. But Girls Aloud, honestly, some of their songs are just outstanding. And they kind of did become critically acclaimed, but they've almost been forgotten, I think, now. Spice
it's
Girls
a funny
seem
one,
to the... come back and Girls Aloud don't really get the credit they deserve.
I've got this kind of theory. I think it's terminology that I've come up with, but it's not a new idea. This kind of quarter century revision that seems to happen with a lot of pop music. And I think the thing with the Girls Aloud material is that it's kind of when things are about 10 or 15 years old, although actually with some of that stuff, we're coming up to 20, aren't we, closer with Girls Aloud.
Yeah.
So maybe it's due that. Maybe you're just ahead of that. But you know, when things are about 10 or 15 years old, they've kind of got a bit of a stink on them. And then suddenly when it gets to about 20, 25, that reverts to being nostalgia.
Well, the Beatles had a big stink on them for a while when I was younger.
Right.
People had just stopped talking about the Beatles. And then I think it was when the Sgt. Pepper 20th anniversary came along, that was kind of when they got back into vogue again. So there's completely that sort of thing, yeah. And ABBA weren't taken seriously. ABBA are one of my biggest pop loves. And they weren't taken seriously at all when they were around. They're massively successful, but they were just kind of seen as silly, frivolous Swedes with all their number one singles. And I tell you what, there's a lot to be said for having a lot of number one singles.
Well, yeah. And I mean, again, it's just opinion, but I guess informed opinion. I mean, it's alchemy, the ABBA stuff.
Yeah.
It's that beautiful mix of, like, it's not complexity for complexity's sake, but it's also not dumbed down in any way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
there's that honesty that underpins it, I think, yeah. I think that ABBA were probably the 70s Beatles for me in terms of being able to just harness pop magic and then Pet Shop Boys probably in the 80s that did the same thing.
Right. I think it's some of the stories with the ABBA stuff, the narratives that they chose to write about and stuff that was going to get into the top five in the charts. Really, you say, people use that term, the kind of frivolous, don't they? But a lot of the stuff that they're writing about, really adult and kind of, I don't know, really adult kitchen sink kind of themes, but
I mean, they were doing that
quite specific.
They were doing that for a big chunk of their career because Waterloo was 74, and then by about 78 was when they started doing stuff that was more adult, and even something like Super Trooper, which was 1980, I think, and people think the Super Trooper movie is about someone it's about being a pop star and being on stage, and you're the Super Trooper. But when you listen to the lyrics, it's about being depressed on tour. and the Super Trooper is the name of the spotlight. That's the actual name of the spotlight. The chimes right, on okay. you on stage, and it's kind of like, oh no, here I go again on stage, feeling really shit, with the Super Trooper shining on me. I've got to get through it again, and it's a really really right. downbeat song. But it's such it's a great
the juxtaposition of the apparent frivolity of the backing is what gives it its depth. Yeah. Oh man, I'm gonna have to go and do a full on deep dive. and speaking of that time period, something that you've mentioned a couple of times, which really resonated with me because I don't think I'd noticed it, and now can't stop noticing it about music documentaries. I don't know if you remember talking about this because you guys have put so much stuff out there.
Yeah.
The punk documentary tropes, which have now become the rave documentary tropes. I realised that I was totally guilty of this as someone who's apparently a music historian, of being like, oh, well, 1976 to 1977, the only thing that happened in music in Britain was punk. It was British punk.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of the revised narrative. And through a couple of experiences I've been lucky to have with some artists that were around at that time, you realise actually that's completely not the case at all.
Yeah. It was, I mean, that's the thing. It was revolutionary punk. It absolutely was. And it changed the way that people made music in that sense of anyone can do it. Which I was massively into punk when I was like 5. Because my mate's older brother was into the Pistols and the Clash. So me and my mate got into them by osmosis, that way you do with older siblings. So we did form a group. We formed a punk group when we were 6 in my mate's bedroom. And I think one of the lads was just hitting the biscuit tray and the rest of us, we didn't even have any instruments. We were just making noise and shouting because that's what the punks did. So that's the first group I was in. I'd forgotten about that.
Well, that's ultimate punk. Ultimate
DIY. Of course. No instruments. Yeah. It's ultimate punk, isn't it?
Didn't even record it.
So it was, that there is that truth in that it was hugely revolutionary, but at the same time, the prevailing popular stuff was stuff like ABBA, and it was stuff like disco. Disco was enormous, 77. And Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, the Bee Gees and all of that. That was the big stuff. And punk, in terms of commercially, wasn't doing anything, but it did lead on to lots of different stuff, and it did lead on to people being able to do things, and I think that stuck with me, that punk ethos, if you like, of being able to do it yourself, and I kind of have stuck to that in terms of pursuing different career paths and just having a belief that I can kind of pull it off. Sometimes foolishly, but and then leading up to what I do now, which is that ultimate punk thing of having complete control and independence over your output and your distribution. So
that was very.
I was trying to make there, but
No, it's very neatly done. listen, there's one more thing I just wanted to mention before we wrap up. Through some of the various things you've shared, I've become aware of Poprex in Sunderland, talking of kind of DIY, and I guess we talked a little bit about local scenes and stuff. I wondered if you would mind just kind of explaining what Poprex is and what it sort of means to the local music and art scene in Sunderland.
Yeah, Poprex was originally a pop-up shop that was set up by the group, the Sunderland group Frankie and the Heartstrings, back in 2012, I think it was. And they only initially were going to do it for 2 weeks to promote the album they were releasing at the time. So they did a gig in the place, and they were selling records in there, and there was a coffee machine, and it was just a kind of a space for people to go and hang out, and a nice little promotional thing. It was a bit different. And it's never went away. It's still going. And it's been in various incarnations and in various venues over those 10 years. And it's grown and grown into somewhere where it's a cultural hub, if you like. Like a slightly wanky type of term, but if it's
become that by dint of just being there and sticking around, then it genuinely is, isn't it?
Well, it is, and it's stuck around down to one man, who was the drummer in the group, Dave Harper, who sadly passed away last year. And he was the absolute driving force behind it, kept it going when really there were plenty of times when it should have just faded away and stopped. And Dave's passion for local music and local culture kept it going. So that there's stuff like they have sessions for local musicians to meet up. There's been exhibitions on there. There's been loads of gigs there over the years, kind of bands that normally wouldn't play in that kind of venue, but because Dave was able to get in their ears and persuade them to come along and do shows. I mean, the Charlatans played there on one occasion, and the Charlatans, they sell out like 2,000 capacity venues and stuff like that regularly still. There's been authors have gone there and done talks and things like that. There's been all kinds of things. They have a mental health drop-in group. They work with the local food bank quite a lot. There's a knitting group on a Saturday morning for people to go along and do knitting and crocheting. And it's just this place where people can go and express their creativity and hang out with like-minded people. And during the day, it operates as a coffee shop, and they do food as well now, and pizzas on weekend evenings and all this kind of thing. And it's just... it hasn't really got a definition. It's there, and it's that kind of like what works, and we'll do whatever we need to do to keep going.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, they've become one of my favourite follows on Instagram, because even though I'm not local to the area in any way, it's just it warms my heart to know that there are places like that that seem to be I don't know, thriving and serving. Yeah, creative arts community and just doing something really good.
I mean, so but
you sort of introduced me to that, so
this I wanted is going to, out, wanted I think to mention a few, this is going out a few weeks after we've recorded it, I think.
I'm
nipping down to Pop Rex later on today, and I'm going to have a chat because we're talking about starting a film night. So once a month we'll show a film, and hopefully that'll get some people through the doors and a few quid in the coffers. So just that thing of... a little cultural treehouse almost, where people can get together and enjoy the stuff that they love. So that'll be fun. We did the first show on the Top Flight Time Machine tour there in 2019, and we've had to postpone our Christmas party we were going to do there in December. So that's happening again soon. So Sam loves the place as well. So it's a somewhere that's really close to both of our hearts.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's a great place.
Brilliant. Andy, thanks so much, mate. It's been wonderful chatting to you. Thanks for...
no problem.
Thanks for coming on.
Big thanks to Andy for giving up the time and being such a wonderful guest. Hope you enjoyed that somewhere near as much as I did. I'll speak to you soon. Cheers, everyone.